And we're back here at Dialect Coach's Corner with Michelle Ang. Michelle, now your family or your parents came from Malaysia?
Yes.
Talk a little bit about why they came. I think you mentioned they were students in New Zealand. What do you know anything? Have they ever spoken about what their experiences were? Did they know English when they came? What sort of cultural language experiences did they have?
Okay, yeah. Well, it's interesting actually because Malaysia itself as a country is very interesting. There's three main ethnic races in Malaysia. So you can be Malaysian, but you might be Malay Malaysian, you might be Chinese Malaysian, or you might be Indian Malaysian. And within each of those three races, each race obviously has its own mother tongue. So the Indians speak Hindi, the Chinese, well, I'll get to the Chinese later, the Malays speak Malay. And then the Chinese, Mandarin is the major language, but they have a ton of dialects. So depending on where the origin of your Chinese family comes from in China, that will be the dialect that you speak. So on my dad's side, my paternal side is Hokkien, so they speak Hokkien. And on my mother's side, they speak Teochew. And my granddad was Hakka, which is another very, very, very strange minority. So it's interesting because, yeah, you can imagine in a country where there's that many different languages flying around, how do people communicate? Ironically, the language that binds all of them together is English. Everybody actually speaks English to each other, and that's because of the colonial past. Malaysia was a Portuguese colony. It was also, I think, a Dutch colony at some point, and also a British. My mum and dad learned English in school. In fact, my mum went to a Catholic Irish school, so she never really learnt or studied the language of either Chinese or Malay or anything. She studied in English. But in any, when English is transferred onto any sort of foreign country and culture, they bastardize it in their own weird way. So Malaysian English has its own twang and, you know, like they say, what's a common thing? Oh, what you want, lah? La, they put la on the end of everything in the same way that New Zealanders put a on the end of a sentence. So mum and dad came over to New Zealand speaking English, but with this Malaysian accent or Malaysian rhythm to it. And my mum has really lost it. I mean, she sounds like any other New Zealander, much like myself. Interestingly, my dad, who has been in New Zealand for exactly the same amount of time, has not lost it. So he still speaks with what some people might say quite a strong Malaysian accent. I can't hear it because I was born with it, so I can't tell the difference. Like, my dad's just always sounded like my dad.
You speak primarily English with each other, or do you
So at home we speak English. I mentioned earlier that my parents were interested in educating me in the ways of being able to speak some Chinese. But I was a stubborn little kid and I just refused. So my mum and dad will speak to me mostly in English, sometimes in Chinese, which I understand, but I will always respond to them in English. But then my mum and dad speak to each other in a terrible mixture of what I mentioned before of English, you know, Mandarin, Hokkien, and Teochew, which was very problematic for me because as a child, I was privy to these mixed sentences. So I, as an adult, find it very difficult to differentiate when someone is talking Teochew or when someone's talking Hokkien or when someone's talking Mandarin.
Wow.
So much so that when I go back to Malaysia and hang out with my grandma and my aunties and uncles and I try and construct sentences, everyone laughs at me because I'll throw in, like, I'll be speaking Mandarin and then one word will be completely Hokkien and it would all be jumbled up. Yeah.
What would you say that was the influence of that experience in the way that you spoke English? Is there anything that you can say about it, or were you able to actually keep these ways of communicating in different containers? So when you were at school, you communicated this way, and when you were at home, and you really were able to separate them quite clearly.
Yeah, actually, that's interesting because whilst I, as a child, sort of enforced the fact that I wanted to speak English, there was a sense of like needing to fit in. So obviously that meant in school speaking English with a Kiwi accent, but it meant when my mum took me out to her Malaysian ladies' friends group for like Sunday afternoon tea, and they're all speaking English, but they're all talking like this la, why are you like that la? And then I would have to speak to my aunties, which is what I called them. Mm-hmm. I would have to speak with an adopted Malaysian English accent because I didn't want to be able to hear my difference, you know? It's like, you're right. It was like getting an ear for compartmentalizing the dialects of speaking the same language, really, like English.
Yes, yes. Do you think that that has an influence on your ability to switch back and forth even between the New Zealand English and the general American English that you were using when we first started?
I've never really thought about it like that before, but I'm sure it must have an impact. I mean, even just learning the little bit of like trying to speak Chinese and having an ear for intonation, you know, in Chinese there's five different, like there's ways to say the same sound. So it could be like ta, 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 ta. I'm sure like just being aware of the ability to like have different shapes to that same sound has influenced in some way my attention to detail when it comes to speaking in a different accent.
So you started out dancing, yeah. And that was your first sort of artistic connection and passion and focus and commitment.
Yeah, very much so.
And what was it that made you switch over to something which is more verbal? And
well, I guess you're right. My first instinct of like self-expression was physical. It was really feeling music. Like my mum is very musical. We always were listening to music in the house, and like dancing enabled me to express what I felt about the music through a physical form. But I was always really encouraged to speak. Like I did speech and drama throughout school and was very involved in like plays and that sort of thing. But the way that I segued into acting was just by chance answering an audition in a newspaper for a television show. So this is before we had American Idol. It's before we had any, like, So You Think You Can Dance, before any of those big shows that are now on television. New Zealand had this idea to make a small nationwide competition where children could audition and become competitors, and they could play an instrument, sing a song, or do a dance in any form. There would be a panel of judges, but in between those competitors, there was a troupe, a regular troupe that would entertain by singing and dancing or any or all of the above. Yeah. And I auditioned and became one of these 7 or 8 lucky kids. So every week I was on people's screens entertaining them, and it was a really popular show. It was, I think, the most watched show after the national news. So wow. I became kind of a household name, actually, which was weird as a 13-year-old, you know. And because of the nature of the show, I'd have grandmothers coming up to me being like, oh dear, I saw you last Sunday, you were very good. And then there'd be like, you know, young teenage guys being like, oh, you're that hot girl from television, eh? I saw you on Sunday. Yeah, that was pretty cool. Yeah, like, you know, so it gave me some really great exposure. And from there, it was kind of a natural step to get an acting agent and then transition.
Yes.
Into the more dramatic side of television and acting.
You had talked about speech and drama in secondary school or high school,
mm-hmm.
is what we would call it here. What was the speech aspect of it?
We learned a lot of theory, just about how sounds are made, how to control the various parts of your sound-making apparatus. Like, I can't remember lots of it, but, you know, like, soft palate and hard palate and where the resonance is in your head. And again, it's about awareness. And, you know, to be totally honest with you, it's not like I could sit here and remind you of stuff that I learned, because I can't really remember any of it specifically. Sorry, Mrs. Bartlam. But let me say, it has affected my acting, because, for example, in this particular film, 999, I play a detective. She's a female detective. She's also the only female in her team. And immediately what I decided was, okay, she has to have authority. I mean, I'm a petite woman I need to be heard. I need to convey the sense that I have superiority against some of the other police officers in my team. How do I do that? I need to do it with voice. And so instinctively, I've kind of like absorbed all the stuff that lovely Mrs. Bartlam taught me in speech and drama. And on set, I consciously remind myself to speak from my belly, to have resonance and projection and command presence because of that. Like, so there's all these, I guess there's tools about speech and drama that brought awareness to me about voice, which I then can turn into character traits.
Absolutely fantastic.
Yeah.
Yes. Well expressed, in fact.
Oh, thank you.
Mrs. Butlam?
Yes.
She'd be proud.
Ah.
I wanted to talk to you about the New Zealand sense of humor.
Oh, yes.
What could you say about that, and what is its distinguishing characteristics, would you say?
I'm so glad you asked me this because...
Because I love Flight of the Conchords, by the way. One of my...
I know. Aren't they amazing? They're from my hometown. I used to pay $5 on a Tuesday night to watch them play at the local bar called Indigo. And actually, Brett's mum taught me ballet, which is how I got started in this whole entertainment industry in the first place. And I've done several films of Jermaine, so there you go. It's funny. It's very, very different from American humor. It's the best word that I can think of is like self-depreciating. We find comedy in awkwardness. We find comedy in making ourselves say the wrong thing at the wrong time and then having to deal with the silence in the room afterwards. Like, that sort of thing is really funny, you know? We're not so much, I feel like Americans are really great at that physical comedy, or like the one-liner, like the shooting out, the like hilarious ba-dum-bum shh line. New Zealand comedy is not so much that. New Zealand comedy is a little bit more perhaps in line with like The Office, like the British version of The Office, that, you know, saying something that's totally foot and mouth that makes everyone sort of go, oh, what do we say to that, you know? Yeah, yes. That kind of
yes.
Yeah, that kind of humor.
Do people tell jokes a lot?
It's more like, I don't know, I feel like New Zealanders are more inclined probably to tell embarrassing anecdotes about themselves as opposed to like knock knock who's there jokes.
Yes,
you know.
Yes,
they'll tell like, yeah, like they'll tell stories because, you know, Māoridom, the indigenous people, the Māoris, have a real oral history. Like, they're storytellers. That's in their culture. It's in their blood, which is obviously then seeped into New Zealand culture. Mm-hmm. So it's more likely that someone will tell you a hilarious story about, oh, me and Joe last weekend, oh my gosh, you'll never guess. So we're like tramping up the mountain and then he pulls out this, right? You know, like it's more like they'll be telling hilarious stories and maybe add some hyperboles in or something, like overly...
Yes.
You know, overly enunciate one particular aspect that'll be hilarious and that's funny.
Yes.
Yeah.
I was really struck by you talking about your relationship to your speech training at a time when you really were just sort of learning it as a part of the curriculum that you were doing in school and not drama school.
No, I've never been to drama school. This was just regular old secondary school, high school, whatever you call it here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, No, I never went to acting training. Don't know if that's a good or a bad thing. but no, speech and drama really was just a confidence thing, really. Like learning how to speak properly, learning how to speak poetry and present poetry, learning about like the theory of making sound like from a physical, like body and anatomical sort of viewpoint. And also for me, it was just fun. Like I wanted to explore what it'd be like to like read scenes out of plays and then read proper poetry and yeah.
Well, I wouldn't be doing my job if I wasn't asking you on some level to talk about, besides having seen a lot of American television shows growing up, what are some of the tools that you like to use to get that process going?
It's interesting because of the amount of time I've been in America and, you know, so it's been almost, 6 years or something now? It's not so much of a conscious thing for me. And I would love to land a part where I have to study like a specific dialect. I haven't yet landed a part where that's required, but I definitely have had to do auditions where I've decided to place that character within a specific region. And so with that comes obviously a little bit more sort of consciousness. I watch a lot of things like on YouTube, or like I'll try and find movies where characters from that region speak and sort of like get like a natural, almost like listening to music, like attune my ear to it, like the rhythm and the general flow. And then in terms of specifics, I'll often like play a clip and stop it after every line and like say that same word or the same phrase out loud until my mouth gets like a physical memory of the shapes it has to create. Something that I notice is, I guess in the same way I was explaining that Australians speak skinny, I tend to think a lot about the shape of my mouth. For example, like the Jersey accents, like really everyone like talks at the front of their mouth and it's like longer. I always think about making a lot more space between like the top of my mouth and like the bottom. That's probably not the best one, but I haven't practiced it. But you know, like some accents are like really at the front of your mouth.
Yeah.
Some accents are more at the back, like, you know, in California, it's like more laid back. And like there's all these different places to put accents in your mouth. And I feel like sometimes if I sort of concentrate on that and concentrate on the shape, then that helps get me into the vibe as well. And then always I'll find like linchpin words, words that I know will immediately connect me to where I need to be in the dialect. So I'm just trying to think. Oh, like for example, you know, the Boston accent, what do they say? They always say wicked smart, you know, or like a little catchphrase like that. Yes. That I will practice to like bring me straight back into that zone.
Yes, because a lot of times when you're doing an accent, it's really about maintaining your confidence, and you sort of stray and you need something to sort of bring you back.
Actually very true. Yeah, it's hard to get it word for word perfect, but if you have like the grounding touchstones to come back to,
yes,
then it can sort of save the day a little bit.
Yeah.
And then obviously if I'm lucky enough to have the time or like the resources to like really study things, for example today we were talking about the lazy T on the end of about. Mm. You know, or like the dropping of the R, or like for the Boston accent, the adding of an R on a word that ends in an A, like Honda Accord.
Yeah.
I heard that they do that, right? The Honda Accord. It's wicked hard to park your Honda Accord at the Boston Commons.
Yeah. Now, you had talked about poetry in your speech class. Do you still remember any poems from that you had to learn when you were in school? Little snatches of something that maybe...
Yeah, you know what? I would love to. I'm going to cheat here. I don't remember it off by heart, but he's a very famous New Zealand poet, and
Sweet. It's
beautiful. His name is Hone Tuwhare. So he's of Maori descent. And I am drawn, I always loved the sort of darker poetry. Like I was a big fan of like Sylvia Plath. This is great. I actually read this poem in one of my exams once, and I would love to share it with you. It's called Rain by Hone Tuwhare. I can hear you making small holes in the silence, rain. If I were deaf, the pores of my skin would open to you and shut. And I should know you by the lick of you if I were blind. The steady drumroll sound you make when the wind drops. The something special smell of you when the sun cakes the ground. But if I should not hear, smell, or feel or see you, you would still define me, disperse me, wash over me, rain. Isn't that nice?
That's really, really lovely. Tell us again a little bit more about the poet.
So the poet is a New Zealand poet. He's actually passed away now, Hone Tuwhare. He wrote a lot of poems, mostly about nature, and he also wrote a couple of short stories which have been turned into short films by the New Zealand Film Commission.
Very, very nice.
Yeah, great poet.
I think that's a wonderful note for us to segue out of this delightful interview here on the podcast. I have really enjoyed speaking with you. Thank you so much for coming by, and please, you'll have to certainly come back and talk some more, because we could talk all day about all sorts of issues.
Oh, thank you very much, Jerome. It's been a pleasure. Thanks for chatting with me. I hope that you guys out there have enjoyed listening to a little bit about New Zealand and Malaysia and this crazy hybrid gypsy that is me. It's been a pleasure.
We're going to keep our eye on you. And if we had a studio audience, they'd be standing on their feet, putting their hands together right now for Michelle Ang.